Hello, my name is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with plain snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the November 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article about Bob Dylan that I started last week, and then I'm going to read an article about the new oral history of Pink Floyd, including letters from Syd Barrett. And then a book review written by Cat Stevens and an obituary on Novelty Records early performer Tom Lehrer and a classic album review of Mellow Gold by Beck. So I begin with the article that I started last week about Bob Dylan, titled Young But Daily Growing, Bob Dylan's 18th Bootleg Series installment, Through the Open Window, is an audio analog to A Complete Unknown, an unfurling document of a searing young talent in the act of becoming. But becoming what? Rocker, folky, lover, poet, politician, digging into previously unreleased music from 1956 to 1963, Mojo marvels at Dylan's first great phase, along with its still stunned eyewitnesses. It was earth-shaking, they tell Dorian Leninsky. And here's where I left off last week. Several of Dylan's contemporaries compared him to blotting paper or a sponge, ultra-absorbent. But that suggests he was undiscriminating. That Thal describes a brain more like a sorting machine. He knew what to use right away, what to retain for later, and what to discard. His talent for harvesting material was evident when, a week before Christmas 1962, he flew to London to appear in Evan Jones' BBC drama Madhouse on Castle Street as a folk singer called Bobby with more songs than lines. Thus was the British public introduced to Blowin' in the Wind. Dylan seized the chance to learn English and Scottish folk melodies from London-based singers including Martin Carthy and Bob Davenport, and quickly repurposed them for his own songs. Scarborough Fair yielded the lovelorn girl from the North Country and Boots of Spanish Leather. Not Mum Town, the murderously vengeful Masters of War. This fury of creativity meant that when Dylan performed his first major solo concert at New York's Town Hall on April 12, 1963, he could at last play nothing but his own songs and explicitly close a chapter with the florid prose poem Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie. One song in particular was much bigger than he was. In a masterstroke of managerial synergy, Grossman got Peter, Paul, and Mary to record Blowin' in the Wind, reaching number two on the Billboard charts and winning two Grammy Awards. The trio's version was ironclad evidence of folk's commercial potential. Dylan's songwriting and Grossman's instincts. One night at Club 47 in April, another protest song succeeded in cracking Joan Baez's skeptical shell. Based on the Patriot Game, one of his London discoveries, with God on our side's bitterly sarcastic denunciation of nationalism and war at once transformed Baez's assessment of Dylan's talents and inspired her to pursue her own political convictions. It was as if he was giving voice to the ideas I wanted to express but didn't know how, she told writer David Hajou. When she saw Dylan struggling at the Monterey Folk Festival on May the 18th, she joined him for that song, commanding the audience to pay close attention to its message. advertised by Don Hunstein's famous shot of Dylan and Rotolo walking down Jones Street. Their Free Will and Bob Dylan came out on May the 22nd, May the 27th, and sold in its first week twice what his debut had managed in a year. It had been a long slog, culled from 36 songs recorded over 12 months. At the last minute, Columbia's lawyers had balked at talking John Birch paranoid blues, delayed the album, and allowed Dylan to shake it up for the better, out with 5 older songs, in with Masters of War and Girl from the North Country, recorded in April with new producer Tom Wilson. Here's a little bit of that song, Girl from the North Country by Bob Dylan.
If you're traveling in the North Country fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine. If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds. Please see if her hair hangs long, it rolls and flows all down the bridge.
Dylan then chose John Birch for his debut on The Ed Sullivan Show, leading to a showdown and a walkout. The perverse choice, or a canny one. There's nothing better for a protest singer's reputation than getting censored. The previous autumn, Dylan had cameoed in a Time cover story on Baez as a promising young hobo. Now he merited his own write-up. It was still condescending, calling him a city billy, whose voice sounds as if it were drilling over the walls of a tuberculosis sanatorium, but recognized the significance of Blowin' in the Wind, an anthem for the whole lost crowd he speaks for. None of Dylan's friends considered him a sophisticated political thinker, especially not the Marxist Van Ronks. We lectured him immediately about politics, and he ignored almost all of it, says Thal. Bob didn't give a shit. Liberal? Sure. Anti-racist? Sure. Everyone was. He was not going to be a Marxist, but he did understand that there were different sides to be on, starting with civil rights. Dylan became friendly with members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which he represented the younger generation of the civil rights movement. On July the 6th, Pete Seeger and his confrere Theodore Bickel took him down to Greenwood, Mississippi, to support a SNCC voter registration drive with a concert on the farm of a courageous desegregationist family named McGee. Mississippi was a dangerous place where volunteers had been beaten by far-right vigilantes and local police alike, and activist Medgar Evers had been murdered a month earlier. The concert was a reward for locals that had the courage to show up at the courthouse to register, explains former SNCC photographer Danny Lyon. I just want to sing one song because I haven't slept in 2 nights and I'm a little shaky, Dylan began. But this is about Medgar Evers. As the box set reveals, he was shaky enough that he had to start only a pawn in their game twice. Far from being a stirring civil rights anthem, it's provocatively suggested that both Evers and his murderers were victims of a racist system. And here's part of the song, Only a Pawn in Their Game, by Bob Dylan.
Bush could make your Evers blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim. Behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on a caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. The deputy sheriffs and the soldiers, the governors get paid. The marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate. So he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. So it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
I knew who Dylan was, says Lyon. I doubt any of the audience did. I was struck by their complete lack of response. There was a huge cultural gap between the sharecroppers and Bob Dylan. The movement affected Dylan more than Dylan affected the movement. More successfully, Dylan sang Blowin' in the Wind with the SNCC Freedom Singers and We Shall Overcome with Everybody. A taboo of multiracial, cross-generational unity, which was recreated at the Newport Folk Festival later that month. Grossman ensured that Dylan was the main character of Newport 63. He played nothing but protest songs, three of which he promptly recorded for his next album and sang with God on our side on each of the 3 days, twice with Baez. Headlining Friday night, Dylan appeared to close with Hard Rain, but returned mob-handed with Peter, Paul, and Mary, Baez, Singer, and the Freedom Singers to sing Blowin' in the Wind, and a spontaneous encore of We Shall Overcome. Biko called it the apogee of the folk movement, proving that the idealistic communitarian spirit of Pete and Woody had weathered the storm of McCarthyism and entranced the rock and roll generation. Folk was now the favorite music of pre-Beatles America, but Dylan's importance was not yet obvious beyond New York and Newport. In the summer of 1963, when the word hootenanny was slapped on TV shows, movies, magazine, candy bars, and pinball machines, his own version of Blowin' in the Wind didn't even scratch the charts. When Baez invited Dylan to join her on a short tour of the East Coast, she soon noticed that her audience only perked up when she was singing with him. So she started joining him for more songs. Shrinking the gulf between their styles, Baez sounded harsher and Dylan sweeter. One night on the tour, Dylan overreacted to a run-in with a snotty hotel clerk with spectacular results. When The Ship Comes In, Rolling Menace came out because Susie Rotolo had been designing the set for an off-Broadway revival of Bridge on Bridge. While visiting her during rehearsals, Dylan had seen the black soprano Mickey Grant sing Bridge and Wheels' Pirate Jenny, in which a put-upon hotel maid fantasizes about being rescued by a crew of pirates who massacre her oppressors at her command. Dylan was agog and channeled with its apocalyptic violence via the Bible into his songwriting. Woody had never written a song like that, he gasped in Chronicles. It wasn't a protest or topical song, and there was no love for people in it. Although it was an awkward fit for Martin Luther King Jr.'s philosophy of nonviolence, Dylan debuted When the Ship Comes In with Baez at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August the 28th. Here's some of that song, When the Ship Comes In, by Bob Dylan.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins. The hour that the ship comes in, and the sea will split and the ships will hit, and the sands on the shoreline will be shaking, and the tide will sound and the waves will pound, and the morning will be a breaking. The fishes will laugh as they swim out of the path, and the seagulls, they'll be smiling. And they arrive.
The pair also sang Only a Pawn in Their Game and joined black folk singer Lynn Chandler on the civil rights anthem Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, all to a crowd of 250,000 people. Baez maintains that this was the only time they actually sang eye to eye. It was just too moving to look out at that sea of faces, he told Haju. As his relationship with Rotolo crumbled, Dylan headed straight for Baez's place in Carmel, California, where he glued himself to his typewriter and produced the songs that would complete his third album, including Pirate Jenny's Vengeful Offspring, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, and The Times They Are A-Changin'. Here's a little bit of that song, The Times They Are A-Changin', by Bob Dylan.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changin'. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changin'.
When the Times They Are A-Changin' was released on February 10th, 1964, 7 of the 10 tracks were protest songs, so listeners reasonably assumed that Dylan was still in a finger-pointing mood. In fact, the title track was the last explicitly political song he would record for 8 years. Dylan's landmark show at Carnegie Hall on October the 26th, 1963, fills the 7th and 8th disc of Through the Open Window, and displays a talent in full flower. Whether tender, hilarious, charming, or chilling, he's in complete control of the room. You can hear the brand new Hattie Carroll cast its spell in real time. His introduction gets no response, but by the end, the applause is explosive. It was earth-shaking, remembers Collins. When an artist comes through with something that vibrates with the whole community, it's extraordinary. To Thal, the mob of fans outside was a premonition of Beatlemania. Not to infect America till the following February. After the show, she and Rotolo served as decoys, climbing into Dylan's car while he sneaked out the back. It was weird. Literally, there were little girls crawling all over, bouncing on the car. I understand why famous people are terrified. The show itself was clearly the end of the beginning for Dylan. What happened to this kid who came to town a couple of years ago, says Thal. Where is he moving to? He was beginning to be a different person. There was a little bit of envy and a sad recognition that he was going someplace else. Three events explain Dylan's rapid departure from both the village scene and the role of a moralist and pamphleteer, an angry young man with a guitar, a social protest poet, as Shelton put it in his review. The first was a Newsweek hit piece that publicly exposed Dylan's origins. Although few people cared that Dylan was a middle-class Jewish kid rather than a boxcar-riding carny, he was mortified and spat out the bitter, valedictory, restless farewell. The dirt of gossip blows into my face. A second blow was the assassination of President Kennedy on November the 22nd. Opening a show that week with Times, Dylan told biographer Anthony Scaduto, I couldn't understand why they were clapping or why I wrote that song even. Trying to change the world, he told friends, gets you killed. In that dark frame of mind, he collected the Tom Paine Award from the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee at the Americana Hotel on December the 13th, where an FBI informant dryly reported that a young beatnik-type entertainer named Bobby Dylan was not well-received. Surveying a room full of well-to-do liberals, Dylan rambled uncomfortably about his sympathy for Lee Harvey Oswald and his estrangement from the political scene. There's no black and white, left and right, to me anymore, he said. There's only up and down is very close to the ground. And I'm trying to go up without thinking of anything trivial, such as politics. Something snapped that night, 19 months before the legendary electric hearsay of Newport 65. This prickly monologue was Dylan's declaration of independence from the orthodoxies of the folk scene that had been so good to him, the years of flight, repudiation, and creative wildfire were about to begin. I move on to a book review, a book written by Cat Stevens titled Top Cat. The 60s pop star, 70s troubadour, and lifelong spiritual seeker who can't keep it in. Cat on the Road. To find out. Stephen Dmitry Gordiuk may not have enjoyed Nine Lives, but he's certainly had his share. There's the post-war street-loose West End kid who encounters the pull of God and the tug of guilt at his Catholic primary school, the besuited teenage pop star who tours with Hendrix and the Walker Brothers, but is the plaything of the old-school music biz, the acoustic, authentic in beard and jeans, a post-Beatles British singer-songwriter to match Carole King or Neil Young, the tyrannical megastar who loses his rag when John and Yoko are excluded from his end-of-tour New York City soiree. The jealous, zealous convert who changes his name, marries into a Muslim family, and still seems somewhat evigical about the Rashidi fatwa, a bet while utterly condemning violence. The school chairman and tireless charity worker who is refused entry to Israel and turned away from the U.S. The peacenik patriarch who returns to music in 2006 and played the Glastonbury Legends slot in 2023. Inevitably, it's the early chapters of this chronological saga that grip tightest. As our hero surfs the 60s in an adjective-heavy prose that tends to the purple. The first cat is a driven pop star who argues that he should headline over Jimi Hendrix at a fairground in Gothenburg because he's had more hits and his mother is Swedish. When he's offered the part of Buttons in a 1967 Painto, he realizes his career is already over. TB forces him into an extended convalescence in West Sussex, where he experiences a transcendental flash of light and returns to the guitar he's played at Les Cousins' floor spot mid-decade. That brief pop ride has made Stevens profoundly wary of his wild world and those fine feathered friends whose friendliness depends on how you do. Alone above his father's cafe off Shaftesbury Avenue, in a white carpeted room which shares a toilet with another flat, the tunes pour out. Stevens' telling blend of vulnerability and intensity and those naive early album covers brilliantly surf post-hippie idealism in a manner only matched by John Lennon's Imagine. Now a megastar, Stevens is ambitious and only intermittently self-aware, but he also knows his soul must come first. He's a seeker from the beginning, a classic 60s pilgrim who reads Be Here Now and always yearns to find and obey his God. The albums and the tours keep coming, but as the 70s wear on, the songs become more elusive. When Stevens nearly drowns while visiting label boss Jerry Moss in Malibu, the clock is ticking. As Dylan embraces Christianity, Yusuf finds Allah and turns his back on music. Unfortunately, he's found his spiritual home on the eve of the Iranian fundamentalist revolution and the emergence of Islamophobia. His commitment to his faith is steadfast, his good works admirable, and Western hostility unremitting. It will take Yusuf a mere 28 years to return to music and reclaim his crown, now a smiling, if guarded, moderate, finally able to enjoy his faith and his gift. Morning has broken. Here's a little bit of that song, Morning Has Broken, by Cat Stevens.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing.
And now, the article about Pink Floyd titled The Madcap Writes. A new oral history of Pink Floyd brings never-seen letters from Syd Barrett. Interstellar Overdrive, Flaming, Scream, Thy Last Scream, Long Gone, and the alternative title of Dark Globe, Wouldn't You Miss Me, from Pink Floyd's The Piper at the Gates of Dawn in 1967 to Barrett in 1970. Syd Barrett's recording career only lasted 3 years, but within his songs, his tragic arc can be traced, from the blazing English psychedelia of Piper to the Lost in the Woods acid martyrdom of his solo work and the years of absence that preceded his death in 2006. The myths around Barrett have been foaming for more than 50 years, but now fresh insights arrive with new Pink Floyd book, Shine On. Subtitled The Definitive Oral History, it's written by prominent Floyd historian and Mojo contributor Mark Blake, who has distilled a lifetime's fandom and a 33-year interviewing relationship with the band into a compelling retelling of the story, from the principal's origins to the present day. Now unpublished and rare discussions with all the main players and a dizzying plethora of intimates are now joined by something to astound, a stash of letters from Barrett to his former Cambridge girlfriend, Jenny Spires, dating from January to September 1965. I met and interviewed Jenny about 15 years ago, says Blake. We hadn't spoken for a few years, but she got in touch and said, I've got these letters that have fallen through the cracks. They'll fill in the gaps of 65. And what was such a revelation to me about them is that they actually do. You've got Nick Mason and Roger Waters years later talking about trying to get on Ready, Steady, Go. And then you've got Syd actually telling you about it in real time. He's the one person who would be underrepresented because he never gave an interview after 1971. So you have these unpublished letters is to have new interview material. Effectively, I think it gives it a real lift. Everyone's talking about him, and then you've got him talking himself. They're an honest reflection on what was going on in his head as a young man, Blake continues. There's one letter where he's slightly upset because the band had actually broken up. Nick Mason and Roger Waters were working as architects and getting on with real life. But they get together a few months later and play at a party with David Gilmour's group called Jokers Wild. He talks about his first recording session as well. He hates the sound of his voice and feels quite intimidated being in a little studio in West Hampstead. There's also a lovely line which relates to sharing a room in London with Roger Waters. You can have too much of Roger, even though he's a good mate. Relaxed, lucid, and playful, this is the young Barrett in the ascendant, as alive and vivid as any of the interviewees. As well as reflecting on matters, Floyd, the letters find him digging the small faces, narrating bouts of toothache and chicken pox, and employing the excellent maxims, twist and groove a groove, and also decorating his letters with pop art graphics. It's just a shame he didn't talk more later, or that there aren't more letters about what was going on from 1967, 1968 onward, says Blake, when things weren't going so well for him. In these carefree missives, the impending darkness of Barrett's mental illness, exacerbated by drug use, is implicit. This is a place Shine On goes to. Let Go from the group in early 1968, Barrett's spectral afterlife in the saga includes turning up at Floyd's studio dates in the 1970s. unreadable chance meeting with old friends, being sectioned and retreating to hermitdom in the family home in Cambridge. Another interviewee is Barrett's youngest sister, Rosemary Breen, who calls him by his real name, Roger, rather than his nickname. To me, that was a pivotal moment to actually sit down and talk to a family member, says Blake. You realize there's all this bullshit that has been built up over the years, and you're confronted by a much clearer picture of the reality of it. She did say to me that her and her mom had blamed Pink Floyd in the past for what befell, but she knew that there was a bigger problem. There's also Jenny and Sid's other girlfriends who stayed in Cambridge, who were like, this is a guy I had a relationship with in the 60s, when he was this young, beautiful man, and now he's this damaged individual being shepherded around a department store by his sister, or pottering around on his bicycle, and we're told not to talk to him. Another motivation for the book, says Blake, is that the end is closer than the beginning. They've sold their catalog to Sony, which we talk about in the book, he says. I think there's a feeling that they're letting it go and a sense of relief that they're no longer shackled to this beast. There's also an element of wanting a final word, certainly in David Gilmour's case, to right a few wrongs and explain that his contribution was greater than it was sometimes made out to be, rather than the idea that it was Roger Waters that did it all. It will be really interesting to see how things pan out over the next few years, because Sony paid a fortune. It's not going to lie dormant, is it? Shine On will at least tie up the band's direct involvement in Pink Floyd, and ultimately the art, triumphs, and sublime madness of their self-contained world should outweigh moral rancor. It's easy to think that with all the bile and drivel that's gone on, that there was never any companionship or joy to be shared amongst us, says Gilmour, who admits he used Sid Barrett's bird feeder in his garden for a while. But there certainly was. Okay, now I'm going to read an obituary about one of the great novelty artists who passed away on July the 26th. And that was Tom Lehrer. And this is titled, We Will All Go Together. Tom Lehrer, urbane pioneer of musical satire, left us on July the 26th. Although his musical footprint is slight, 3 original albums, 50 or so recordings, and a little more than 100 concerts, the New York-born satirist Tom Lehrer is worthy of a place among the most influential talents of the post-war comedy boom, inspiring countless writers to shrug off the shackles of taste and deference to the establishment. Lehrer always considered himself a mathematician and teacher, however, preferring lecturing to performing. A childhood fan of Danny Kaye and Gilbert and Sullivan, Lehrer, born 1928 in New York, was a math prodigy, entering university age 15. His earliest song, Fight Fiercely, Harvard, poked fun at how his alma mater's refined ambitions clashed with the rough and tumble of college sports. Once the institution got the joke, it would be performed before every home football match. And here's a little bit of that song, Fight Fiercely, Harvard, by Tom Lehrer.
Fight fiercely, Harvard, fight, fight, fight. Demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless, we have the will. How we will celebrate our victory, we shall invite the whole team up for tea. How jolly! that spheroid down the field and fight, fight, fight. Fight fiercely, Harvard. Fight, fight, fight. Impress them with our prowess. Do. Oh, fellows, do not let the crimson down. Be of stout heart and true. Come on, chaps, fight for Harvard's glorious name. Won't it be peachy if we win the game? Oh, goody, let's try not to injure them. But fight, 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 let's not be rough, though.
While working towards a PhD, he never realized Lair gained a reputation playing Boston nightclubs and, in January 1953, spent an hour recording an album, Songs by Tom Lehrer, to sell at shows, pressing 400 copies. By the end of the decade, sales had passed 350,000, with a significant proportion of them in the UK, where the BBC banned 10 of the LP's dozen songs, thus making it an essential purchase. In 1959, Lehrer released two albums, one a 10-inch studio collection, More of Tom Lehrer, the other a 12-inch live set, An Evening Wasted with Tom Lehrer. The first album contained exactly the same songs, but Lehrer wrote in the sleeve notes to An Evening Wasted, "Spares you Mr. Lehrer's sporific spoken commentary, as well as the live audience reaction, which mars this recording. Also, it's cheaper." However you heard them poisoning pigeons in the park, the masochism tango, and we will all go together when we go, pushed the envelope as far as possible in the 1950s. And here's some of the song Poisoning Pigeons in the Park by Tom Lehrer.
Spring is here, a suffering is here. Life is skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide. The sun's shining bright, everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. La, la.
And here's some of the song, The Masochism Tango, by Tom Lehrer.
I ache for the touch of your lips, dear, but much more for the touch of your whips, dear. You can raise welts like nobody else as we dance to the masochism tango. Let our love be a flame, not an ember. Say it's me that you want to dismember. Blacken my eye, set fire to my tie as we dance to the masochism tango. At your command, before you here I stand, my heart is in my hand. Ugh. It's here that I must be. My heart entreats, just hear those savage beats, and go put on your cleats, and come and trample me. Your heart is hard as stone or mahogany. That's why I'm in such exquisite agony. My soul is on fire, it's aflame with desire, which is why I perspire when we tango.
And here's part of the song, "We Will All Go Together When We Go," by Tom Lehrer.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes.
Lehrer, though, had had enough of live performance. His 1960 tour of New Zealand and Australia led to a backlash from extremist conservatives and dedicated himself to mathematics. In 1964, he submitted songs to the U.S. version of the topical TV show That Was the Week That Was, releasing most of them himself on the 1965 album That Was the Year That Was. By now, satire had caught up with Lehrer, but songs such as National Brotherhood Week and Wernher von Braun still skewered the hypocrisy of his homeland's leaders. Beyond that, however, with the exception of songs for children's educational TV and the occasional recording of lost songs, 1952's Risqué, I Got It from Agnes, was only officially recorded in 1966. He had retired from music. If an idea came to me, I'd write, and if it didn't, I wouldn't, he explained. Gradually, the second option prevailed over the first. Here's a little bit of the song, I Got It from Agnes, by Tom Lehrer.
I love my friends, and they love me. We're just as close as we can be. And just because we really care, whatever we get, we share. I got it from Agnes, she got it from Jim. We all agree it must have been Louise who gave it to him. Now she got it from Harry, who got it from Marie. And everybody knows that Marie got it from me. Giles got it from Daphne, she got it from Joan, who picked it up in County Cork, a kiss in the Blarney Stone. Pierre gave it to Sheila, who must have brought it there. He got it from Francois and Jacques. Aha! Lucky Pierre. Max got it from Edith, who gets it every spring. She got it from her daddy, who just gives her everything. She then gave it to Daniel, whose spaniel has it now. Our dentist even got it, and we're still wondering how.
In 2020, Lehrer moved all his music and lyrics into the public domain, meaning there's no charge if you want to attempt the elements. His Pirates of Penaissance-inspired tour de force. See TomLehrerSongs.com for words and music. And here's part of that famous song, The Elements, by Tom Lehrer.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, and radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
And now it's time for the classic album review. And this week, it's Mellow Gold by Beck, released in 1994. Lo-fi production, old-school hip-hop beats, funky guitar melodies, incomprehensible lyrics, and one crazy white boy who loves to rap. Mellow Gold is undoubtedly a strange album, possibly Beck's weirdest creation. This was my first taste of Beck, and I had no idea what to make of it. People kept on telling me different things about the guy, and I didn't really know where to start, so I picked up the cheapest album of his that I could find. After collecting most of Beck's discography, I quickly realized why this album was the cheapest. I don't personally think that this is Beck's worst effort, but damn, it sure does sound half-assed. Not that that's a bad thing. Beck's nonsensical lyrics and mumbled rapping go well together, given the right circumstances. Lo-fi production and hip-hop do not usually mix, but somehow it works on Mellow Gold. The combination gives the music a heavy trailer trash atmosphere. Most of these songs sound like Beck came up with the lyrics on the spot and then decided to record them with some old dusty equipment that he found out by the garbage disposal. Sounds awful, doesn't it? If it weren't for Beck's lovable lyrics and relaxed personality, then this album would have been a mess. Tracks such as Loser, Soul Suckin' Jerk, and Fuckin' With My Head all feature Beck rapping over old school beats and greasy guitar melodies. And here's a little bit of the song Loser from Beck off the album Mellow Gold. Bit of the song Fuckin' With My Head by Beck. Mm-hmm. While most of the rap songs featured on the album can get too lazy and uninspired, for their own good, I always find myself humming along and then, regardless of how stupid the lyrics are. It may be stunning, but the hip-hop tracks are quite normal compared to the rest of the album. Beck covers plenty of genres, such as hillbilly folk, hypnotic psychedelia, steal my body home, and punk motherfucker. The album's spontaneity is what makes it so lovable. You never know what's coming next. At points, Mellow Gold can get a little too out of control. Sweet Sunshine is a prime example. It's made up of a sludgy beat and Beck's extremely heavy distorted vocals. You can't make out a single word he is saying, but the song eventually wanders off into a wall of random noise and sound effects. The album's closer, Black Hole Sun, is another folk-influenced song, and it's another one of the more experimental tracks off the album. Beck plays his a strangely tuned acoustic guitar that kind of sounds like a sitar. He mumbles over the instrument, and the music just goes nowhere. Mellow Gold isn't Beck's finest achievement, but it's certainly his most hip-hop-oriented and laid-back release. Although I enjoy the lazy atmosphere of the album's sometimes Mellow Gold gets too trashy and laid back for its own good, the lo-fi production and the hip-hop-influenced music was a unique and original idea. It's not the best combination, but Beck gives us an entertaining and interesting album with Mellow Gold. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the December 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an interview with Bruce Springsteen, and then The Rise and Fall of the Fine Young Cannibals, and a classic album review of Black by Metallica. Until then, this is Andy Bomek for Mojo Music saying so long. And keep rocking.